The theme for this presentation, as has been announced, is the remnant of faith and their vindication. It is also a testimony of how God has led my family and me in my early life. So I will relate to you this morning some of the events that took place while I was a child in Nazi Germany. I will tell you right at the beginning that we were not Nazis. We did not like them. We did not cooperate with them. We were the black sheep in white clothing, the clothing of righteousness of the Lord. But in their eyes, of course, since we were nonconformist, Seventh-day Adventist Christians in a state that was controlled by police and by absolute power, so that when we wanted to visit our aunt, which lived 5 miles away in the same city, we needed to get a permit from the police. We could not simply travel or visit or just move around. Everybody knew where everybody was at everybody's time. We had a family that spied on us, who lived in the flat on top of us, and they had a fantastic radio. We had only the people's radio. The people's radio is the one station radio, just like in the former Soviet Union. You could have one station only on that radio, and that radio was called the people's radio, just like there's a people's car, a Volkswagen, so there was a Volks radio. We had a Volks radio. But the people upstairs who were Nazis, they had a wonderful radio. Since we had only a one station radio, we could never listen to BBC London and the Voice of America and all these stations from the outside that you were not permitted to listen to. So we were blessed by having this tiny radio. But the people upstairs who were spying on us, I'm sure, put their ears many times against the wall to hear what was going on downstairs. And we did too. Every day at 6 o'clock, they listened illegally to BBC London, and so did we. So there are all kinds of blessings in disguise. Yes, the Lord has His own ways of taking care of His people. I have my Bible opened to Daniel chapter 3. The book of Daniel is one of my favorite books in the Bible. It is one of my favorite books because it has these stories, these Bible stories in there. And my father, being a fantastic storyteller, was so good in telling us those stories that I can tell you by memory how they work. I can picture in my mind my father telling the stories in such a gripping way that we could work on his heart to say, one more time. And he would tell the same story one more time. And then we'd say, just one more time. And we got him to tell the same story, I remember, 6 times. He was so good. You could just live in those stories. One of them were the three men in the fiery furnace. That was reality for us. We too were in the fiery furnace, or could be in the fiery furnace. So here were men who stood loyal for God in very forbidding circumstances. They were in a foreign country. They were aliens. Have you ever been an alien someplace in another country? Now, I'm happy to have a U.S. passport. And I show this passport to the agencies at the border crossings with pride. But these poor men, they had no passport. They had even received new names to indicate that the new government had authority and power over them. Because the one who gives a name to somebody has authority over that person. Isn't that right? This is why we have the privilege of giving names to our children. We have authority. Sometimes we think even beyond their age 16. But we know better because we once too were 16. And if we are not senile, we know that we were also wanting to be ourselves. So, here were these men, now in government service. We don't know really what happened, but very likely, as Dr. Shea has suggested, and was frequently the case in the ancient world, there must have been a plot to assassinate the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, as he called himself. He called himself even King of the Universe. Now, he didn't know much about the universe. And that was King Nebuchadnezzar, ruling for 43 years. That's a little longer than Clinton will make it. Ruling for 43 years. I don't know how long he will make it because I'm not a prophet nor the son of a prophet, but I do know there are problems. Bless his heart. So, 43 years he was on the throne, and as happened many times in the past, there were plots by chief generals or other powerful people. And there must have been such an occasion, Dr. Shea suggests, and that was the reason why all the people were called into the plain of Dura, and why this golden image was built up. And why, when the state orchestra was to play, everybody was to kneel down in front of the golden image. Now, that doesn't sound so bad, does it? But what was bad was not the golden image. What was really bad was the fiery furnace. It was a life and death matter, wasn't it? And it involved worship, didn't it? Kneeling down, worship, a life and death matter. Don't forget that this is just a small picture of another life and death matter that involves worship at the end. Is that right? So this is just a symbol. These men are types of the remnant of the end time. They were remnant in their time. But now they are types, examples for us. So that as we look into their life, and as we see what kind of decisions they made, we too can make those kinds of decisions and stand firm. The orchestra played, and everybody knelt down, as they were expected to show homage to the God and to the King, except three men, sticking out like sore thumbs. I remember with my wife, Hilda, she would love to be here, quit school yesterday, and I called her last night, and I said, honey, how was it going, your last day? She says, it was one of the worst days. Now, do you sometimes have some of those? She said they started moving my stuff out before school was over, because she has to move from one classroom to another classroom, and she said the kids were so rowdy. I said, did you take them out for ice cream as you had planned? She said, yes. Well, that's why, I said. Blood sugar. Blood sugar. You know, she got them all up, and then she was surprised. I mean, next time it will be sugarless yogurt, just like over here. Well, so here these men were there, and Hilda and I, we were in Rome several years ago. And of course, if you're in Rome, what do you want to see? You want to see the Mamertine prison, the very prison where the Apostle Paul was located. And if you go down, there's a little stairway to go down now, and you can look up, there's this little opening in the rock through which all the prisoners were let down. And the opening is that big. So I know Paul was not that big, because he had to go through the hole. There was no stairway. So Paul was a slim man, or he wouldn't have made it. He dictated a letter from this prison, Philippians. Go home and read it. It's a letter of joy. Paul also knew that his life would come to an end. That's where he was. That's what you want to see in Rome. Of course, when you're in Rome, you want to see something else, right? You want to see the beautiful churches and the museums. Yes, you do. And don't do what happened to this Adventist pastor. He was driving with his car in those narrow streets in Rome, and he came to a dead end, and he couldn't turn the car around, and he looked, and there were stairways going down about 200. So he took his car and drove down the stairways. Now, don't do this. stairways are to go up on your knees towards the churches, not to drive with cars down. So be very careful in your driving. Rome is different. But you do want to, in Rome, also see the Pope. And so did we. I mean, after all, he's a Bible figure, isn't he? So in that case, we might as well take a look at the person who really looks. What is he like? Because these are highly intelligent people, aren't they? And so my wife and I thought, well, we're going to see the Pope. But we found out that he was not in Rome. He was in his summer castle outside of Rome, Castel Gandolfo. So we drove outside on Sunday morning because at 10 o'clock he was to give an audience. That is, people would gather together in the inner courtyard of that castle, and there were about 10,000, and you were crowded together. And at 10 o'clock he would appear, he would say words in different languages, and then at the ringing of a bell, he would give his papal blessing when all the faithful saints, the Catholics, would kneel down, as is customary for them. And my wife said, Gerard, what are we going to do when the bell rings? Well, since I was in the Catholic instruction, you know, for half of my educational life in Germany, I said, we'll do what we always did. Protestants don't kneel down in front of a human being. We don't give acts of worship to a human being or whatever that symbolizes for them. We just remain standing. And I said, look, there are people from Sweden over there. They're all Lutherans. There are no Catholics hardly in Sweden. They're all Lutherans. So they'll do the same thing. And then there were people from the United States. They had T-shirts on. I love T-shirts. And I would recommend that we would copy what they had done, because they had on the T-shirt, I am a proud, and then they had that denomination underneath. Now, I won't give the denomination because that's not important. But sometimes I think, shouldn't we have for camp meeting all a T-shirt and say, I'm a proud Seventh-day Adventist, put proud in quotation marks and have in small letters, holy pride underneath. I mean, we have to have the right spirit in all things, don't you think? So sometimes we want to hide who we are. We don't have to hide anything. No, we are God's people. We are the remnant. And we know our Lord Jesus Christ in heaven. And we walk, hopefully, day by day, the walk of faith with him. That's what these three men did then in ancient Babylon on the plain of Dura. And so when the bell rang in this big courtyard, you wouldn't believe it. The majority of the people were right away down on their knees. And then some people looked back and forth. And before you knew it, the I am proud so-and-so did the same thing that everybody else did. And then we looked around, and it was Hilda and I who were standing. Now, don't tell anyone, but I'll tell you now that an idea came to my mind. But you don't tell that idea to anybody. And I don't know where it came from. The idea all of a sudden was, and I don't know why it came, but it was there. Lord, give an elevator underneath our feet that we will be lowered to the same level without kneeling. It could not have been a prayer from the Lord. It was an idea that came out of what we call group pressure, right? We wanted to be different, and yet we didn't want to be different. That's the way it goes. That's the struggle of faith and the life today. We want to be different, and yet we don't. And yet we have to be different. Well, before we knew it, all the people were up again. We got the papal blessing. It's good for only 5 years, so we've got to go back again. So, humor aside, here were the three men in the plain of Dura. They did not bow down. And sometimes I wonder if I would be in a situation like this, because God has given us a mind to think, hasn't he? And it would be so normal to say, well, to kneel down, I know that this is just gold, it's just metal, it's no God, it's just something human hands have made. To just kneel down would mean nothing. I know this is a no God. I'm not doing anything wrong. That's very logical. So it would be much better, you know. I'm in government service, in a very high position. I have influence. I can help other people of my own faith, other Jews. I could have thought in those days, maybe I just kneel down and quickly polish my shoes. No, do something else. But they did not. Because they didn't even want to give the wrong impression. Right? They really wanted to be straight all the way and right with the Lord all the way. And I like them. Do you like them? I like these fellows. I like to meet them. We will have some conversations. I'll ask them the question whether they ever thought about polishing their shoes. And they will say no, because we didn't know what shoes were. We wore sandals. So I'll ask them, did you ever think polishing your toenails? The same thing, you know. Did you ever think about those things? I don't think they did. But I'll ask them anyway, because I'm a curious person. So before they knew it, they were ushered in to the presence of Nebuchadnezzar, who, when he had his thumb up, it was life, and when he put his thumb down, it was death. He was the absolute ruler. He had power over life and death for most people, and he thought for all people. But he was slightly mistaken. But I like the man too, because Nebuchadnezzar is going to be in heaven. Did you know that? He will be. He had his ups and downs, but he's going to be in heaven. And I know how he looks like. You want to know how it looks like? Go to Chicago. In Chicago, you have the Oriental Institute. The Oriental Institute is a museum. They've got a bust out of granite, black granite. And you can look at Nebuchadnezzar. He was a man of intelligence. You can see it on his face. He had a curly beard, said to be 1,000 curls in his beard. Men, if you have a beard, copy him, if you can afford it. He was a very intelligent being. And he said to these three men, this shows you how benevolent he was. He says, is it true? That was a rhetorical question. Didn't need an answer. Is it true that you didn't bow down? I'll tell you what. I'll have the orchestra play one more time. Just do me a favor. I treasure your services. You are good servants of the government and of me. I don't desire to kill you. Give me a chance. I will play one more time. Kneel down. And everything is forgotten. And wasn't he nice? I mean, from his point of view. He was not like Adolf Hitler. No, no. He wanted to give them a second chance. Come on. Be reasonable. Oh, he did make another statement, and that was a fatal statement. In chapter 3, verse 15, the last sentence. It was a statement that said something about his way of thinking about himself. That last question, what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands? Oh, he knew that this idol was just an idol. This idol could not deliver them out of his hands. He knew that. He was intelligent. He knew that idols had limitations. And he thought all gods were as limited as idols are. And so he asked a fatal question. And that question showed the great controversy. The great controversy between human powers who are used by Satan and between God, who is the sovereign Lord of the universe. That's what it was. He says, who can? And then the three say, if it be so, our God, verse 17, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire. And he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. Man, they were bold, weren't they? They said, we serve a God, And by the way, brothers and sisters, that is our God, isn't it? We serve that same God who has power over the fire of life and the fire of destruction. And we have the choice to make whether we want to perish in the fire or whether we want to have life through the Lord who is Lord over the fire. Is that right? We have that choice. And these three young men made that choice for that God. Because he's the creator of everything. He created fire so he can control fire. He can do the most impossible things that reason will never understand. And as far as I'm concerned, they won the battle. They told the king the truth. We have a God. We have a God who can do things none of the other gods, the no gods, can do. And he can deliver and will deliver. But they didn't stop there. Their faith was more profound than that confession. Because we need to read the second part of their little speech to the king, which is in verse 18. And it's the second part, brothers and sisters, that is the toughest for all of us. 2. But even if he does not deliver us, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you've set up. I love it. They had a faith that was big enough, was profound enough, had reached the total apex, so that even though our God can save us from the fiery furnace, king, we want you to know, if our God chooses not to save us, we are still not going to serve you. What do you think about that? There's nothing more profound in the whole Bible. That our confidence in God is so strong, our faith is so deeply grounded, that whatever crisis shall hit us in life, and we all face our crises, we will still remain loyal to the God whom we know can take us out of the crisis or can keep us in the crisis, even to death. That's the highest. As a matter of fact, I tell you, that's the faith I need more of. That commitment that goes to the very core of our existence. Well, verse 19, Nebuchadnezzar was filled with wrath. His facial expression was altered. I've seen people whose facial expressions were altered sometimes. Not what you want to see very often. Once every 5 years is enough. Not talking about my wife. Please, don't reach wrong conclusions. But we do know other saints and human beings, we all do. And sometimes our own facial expressions become altered. And that's when we need to think about Christ and what he would do, right? At that moment. So they were thrown in the fiery furnace. And it's only at that moment, if I'm honest with you, that I would like to have been there, standing next to the king. Only at that moment, not before. At that moment. And honestly, on the basis of this incident that is reported here, I wouldn't have liked to look into the fiery furnace, yes, just for 1 second, to see what the king saw. But then I would like to have looked in his face. Because of anger, because of the opposition he received, because of the acknowledgement, there's somebody higher than the greatest king. And that these men will be loyal to the greatest of the great, the heavenly Lord of the universe. That made him angry, that they weren't obedient to him. And I tell you, we will make Satan angry today if our loyalty to God goes to that level and height and apex. Isn't that right? We will. And we too will experience the kind of things that these men experienced, each one of us, in their own or in our own ways. But we have to remain loyal, as they remained loyal, because God's saints are never alone in the crisis of life. Here they were in the fiery furnace, and then I would like to have seen the king. The Babylonians are known for arithmetic. He could count 1, 2, 3. Hey, there's a fourth one. Look at him. And everybody gazed in this superheated fiery furnace. And the king says, hey, he looks like a son of God. He recognized. There's a fourth one in, and they're walking around in there. He says, it can't be. I mean, I made sure I gave an order to heat that furnace 10 times hotter. I don't know how that can be done, because we heated our house with a wood furnace, and sometimes I superheated the wood furnace by purpose to burn out the creosote. Very dangerous procedure. I don't recommend it to anybody. It's a lazy man's job of cleaning out the furnace pipes. Don't recommend it. I did not know that there were 700, 800, 1200 degrees in those pipes. But my pipes, which were good pipes, I bought good stuff. Praise the Lord. So he prepared me. My pipes were getting cherry red, were getting hotter and hotter. If they wouldn't have been out of stainless steel, I don't think they would have made it. I don't have a wood stove anymore, folks. No. So, superheated, they were in there. And what does he see? He sees, like verse 25 says, look, I see four men loosed and walking about in the midst of the fire without harm, and the appearance of the fourth is like a son of God. So Jesus Christ was with those three faithful ones when they were right there in the middle of the fire. I can tell you one thing, Jesus Christ is going to be with every one of you in the middle of the fire of your life. He's right next to you. If you think he's the furthest away, read that text and know he's right next to you. The only problem is that you have to see him with the eye of faith. But he's there. He is there. Jesus Christ has promised to us, I will be with you, didn't he say? He said, I will be with you even to the end of what? Of the world, of the age. That is our age. He says, I will be with you. And he's with us. I know time is going fast, so I've got to switch from the past to the present and tell you an experience of my mother, tell you an experience of my father, and then tell you an experience of Lodi, California, which we didn't even know was to be pronounced Lodi, since we had not learned English and had never heard of the town. We pronounced that precious city with these wonderful Adventists, Lodi, California. That was the heavenly name for us. In 1943, my mother was invited to become a member of the Nazi Party. You see, if you were not a member, you couldn't become a member. And if you were invited to be a member, you couldn't say no. Different system. So my mother said to this official who came to our house, invited her, and said to her, Mrs. Hazel, you have four children. There's not enough food in the country. But if you become a member of the Nazi Party, you will get additional food rations for your children. That didn't sound bad. You will get for each child 2 pairs of shoes a year instead of one. We got our pairs of shoes in the springtime, and in the fall, my mother would cut out of my shoes the front part so that my toes could continue to grow. And in the winter, I walked with toes in a heavy sock sticking out of my shoes. It would have been nice to have an additional pair of shoes for the winter without cold toes. You would get double the amount of clothing. Everything was rationed. And in the summertime, you would be taken for 6 weeks to a vacation camp where you could eat and gorge yourself with food. No restrictions on food at all. What a tremendous offer to be a member of the Nazi Party. But there is a price to everything in life. There is the flip side of the coin always available. And my mother said to this gentleman, what was the truth, but it was also a very wise response. Sir, I never make a major decision without consulting with my husband. Her husband was 2,500 miles away on the Russian front lines as a faithful Seventh-day Adventist, wearing a gun but not using the gun, living an Adventist lifestyle in very forbidding circumstances. Mail would travel 3 months to arrive and 3 months for a letter to come back. So it was a good delaying tactic. The government put pressure on us. They withdrew my father's paycheck. It did not arrive. We had no bank account. We were Seventh-day Adventist ministers. No extra money. Very low pay. There was nothing in the bank. There wasn't even a bank account. It was a cash flow society for us. So now the check didn't come. She had to pay her rent. We had to pay the electricity. We had to pay the gas bill. We had to have food for the little amount of groceries that you were able to buy under your rations to survive. We were all skinny, very skinny. No wonder we love to eat now. So my mother went to Sister Geiser, one of the saints of the Lord, a deaconess in the church. And in secret, I was with her. She said, Sister Geiser, I'm pressured to join the Nazi party. I have refused by saying that my husband is in the front line. I have to consult with him. And I wouldn't make such a major decision anyway, ever, without consulting with him. And I already know what he would say, but I haven't told him because he hasn't communicated with me and so forth. And we have no more money. What shall I do? What can I do? Oh, Sister Geiser said, no problem. My husband and I, we have some savings in our savings account. How much money do you need, Sister Hazel? And my mother told a certain amount of sum of money. I need to pay this and this and this. Let's see. Oh, Sister Geiser said, here's the money for this month. Sister Geiser gave us all her savings during the 6 months period. She just passed away, 93, a year and a half ago. You know Sister Geiser's going to be up there? You can count on that. You can count on that. After 6 months were over, she had no more money and nobody else had money. Then my mother wrote a letter to my dad, outlining the invitation, telling that we had not received for 6 months his pay while he was doing his duty. And she said, this is very unfair that they're putting this economic pressure on us to force a decision that should be a free decision. What is your counsel? Put the letter in the mail. I took it to the post office. I always picked up the mail, took it to the post office. Within 3 days, my mother got a letter from the Gestapo. The Gestapo head officer of the city of Frankfurt, a city of nearly a million people, had put his handwritten signature underneath the letter. She needed to appear before him on the following Monday. The letter arrived on Friday. My mother knew we all were in deep trouble because she knew that the Gestapo headquarters building downtown Frankfurt had doorknobs to go in, but no doorknobs to go out. It was all electrically controlled if they wanted you to leave again. She also knew that underneath the groundway, there was a direct passage to the big Gestapo prison 2 blocks away. Everybody knew that too. And mother knew that we were in trouble. Yes. On Sabbath, in church, she talked with a lot of members. And I knew what she was talking about. I knew the story. So that was okay. On Sunday, mother said to us children together, tomorrow you will not go to school. And I will talk privately with each one of you, giving you instructions now. So she took my older brother into the living room by himself. When he came out, I said, what did she say? Cannot tell. Wait until your turn comes. My sister went in. Cannot tell. Then I went in. This is what my mother said. I was 7.5 years old. She said, I'll give you the equivalent amount of a quarter. If I'm not home by 2:30 tomorrow, I will not be home by the night, and you will take streetcar 23 in your play clothes, pretending you had been in school. You go downtown, transfer to streetcar 17. I still remember all the numbers. Go to your Aunt Anna, and there will be other Seventh-day Adventists taking you into hiding. You will not know where your brother is going, and you are not permitted to tell him. Because if the police, the Gestapo, catches you, they will pressure you to the utmost to tell them, where is your brother? Where is your sister? Where is your other sister? And so forth. And you can honestly say, I don't know. So I didn't know where they were going. All I knew is that on Sunday at 2:30, if mother wouldn't be home, I wouldn't have my mother anymore. And I wouldn't have my brother anymore, and my sisters anymore, and I would be somewhere among Adventists. I was shattered. On Monday morning we prayed. Mother said, be silent, because the family upstairs are watching every move. You have to pretend as if you're not in the house. No sound, no flushing of toilet, no nothing. Oh, we knew how to do that. We had been trained. She left. Well, we had sheer curtains, just as everybody else has in Germany. You can look out, but they can't look in. So we were behind the sheer curtains in the living room by about 11 o'clock, 11:30, waiting for the streetcar to come by in a distance and watching for the people getting off and waiting for mother to come home. By 2:30, we already wore our play clothes, just one set that we had. I had my little quarter in my pocket and I had it in my hand. We were waiting on the window. 1 o'clock came, no mother. Every 15 minutes a streetcar would come and we would be glued to that sheer curtain, looking beyond. 1:30, no mother. 2 o'clock, no mother. Two more streetcars. And we would all scatter, never to see each other again. 2:15, one more streetcar, still no mother. The streetcar came, the bell was rung on that tram, and people came off, and one lady in the distance was walking fast. And we all recognized her gait instantaneously. It was mother. And we said, Mom! Hellebach, up there, these people can't even shout for joy. So she came in. She had a big smile on her face. She hadn't said anything. She put her arms around us and we squeezed each other and tears were flowing. And then she said, you know what happened? I've got to tell you, let's come into the bedroom. And we went into the closet of the bedroom that these people couldn't hear what had happened. And she told us what happened. She says, I came to the office. You children, you could not imagine what a wonderful office this was. Wood paneling, a fine dressed gentleman behind the desk. And he had the file there, and I was seated, introduced to him. Mrs. Helen Hazel is here now for her appointment. And he turned to me, she said, and he said, Mrs. Hazel, do you know why you are here today? Now, what would you think to say? Yes, I do, or not? And mother said, you know, I just thought I'd tell him. And she said, yes, I have a very good idea why I'm here today. And he said, tell me. She said, I have not joined yet the Nazi party. He said, that's right. He opened up the file and he pulled out a letter. The letter my mother wrote to my dad, telling him about it. So all of our mail had been censored all along. And that letter never went out beyond the post office. It was taken right to the Gestapo office because she told him about the troubles at home. up in the front lines, and he says, why in the world did you write a letter? And he drew a kind of a rage at her, really being angry, saying, you know what you're doing? Here are these men fighting in the front lines for the fatherland, and you are undermining their morale. This is equal to treason, and you have to go to the labor camp, concentration camp. That was the sentence, right there announced to her in her presence. And then he said, rhetorically speaking, as it were, why in the world would you do something like this? And she said, I can explain this to you. And mother said, I would like you to know why. I'm a Seventh-day Adventist Christian, she said. And as a Seventh-day Adventist Christian, I believe that there's a real God in heaven. But the Nazi Party is atheistic and denies the reality of God. And therefore, conscientiously, I could never join the Nazi Party. Was her speech. Laid it down on the line. Gave her reason. And he said, did you just say you're a Seventh-day Adventist Christian? And she said, yes. Yes, sir. He went to the phone, dialed the number, said, I would like to have a confirmation. Mrs. Helen Hazel gave the street. Is she a member of the Seventh-day Adventist Church here in town? Hung up within seconds, mother said. Response came, confirmed. Then the man behind the desk said to her, you know, I've moved 3 years ago to the suburb of Neu-Isenburg into a very lovely home. And our next door neighbors are the Myers. There's only one Meyer family among Adventists. He was an elder. They were Adventists. And then he said, these Myers are Seventh-day Adventists. And when we moved in, can you imagine that they, out of the little food we all have, made a special welcome meal for us and welcomed my wife and me and my two boys. They were so kind. They were the nicest people we ever met any place. Oh, my mother thought that sounds pretty good. And then he said, our relationship with the Myers has increased. They're wonderful people. They're the finest people. He said, they're Seventh-day Adventists like you are. Tell you what, after he thought for a second, he says, your file will be closed. You'll get the checks for the last 6 months in the mail yet this week, and everything is taken care of. Amen. Well, I tell you, I was glad that this man was at that spot, and I'm also delighted about these Seventh-day Adventist neighbors. Real Adventist neighbors. They were. As she was ushered out, he said to her, Mrs. Hazel, I want you to know that I'm not the person whose name is on this sign here in front of the desk. I'm the deputy director. The person whom you were to see today became very ill this morning, but everything is still taken care of. See how the Lord's providence works? So I didn't have to use my quarter that I had in my hand. I didn't have to take streetcar 23 and 17. No, the Lord worked it out. So I believe that people who are making their decisions for the Lord will find their rewards. It is never easy to be an Adventist. Never was promised. It wasn't easy for these men in Babylon to be faithful remnant. It wasn't easy. But it has never been an issue of Christianity and true Adventism and the remnant to be easy. It has always been a matter of the relationship to God. And while he takes care of us in whatever he allows, he will not allow one thing more to happen than what we can bear. Is that right? So that is our loyalty to him. My father, during that time, was way deep in the southern part of Russia, in the Caucasus Mountains. And you know, the Germans never retreated, they only regrouped. So they were constantly regrouping backwards. Constantly regrouping backwards. And my father, of course, knew that from the beginning that Nazism could not succeed. It didn't fit Bible prophecy. He knew the book of Daniel. His commanding officer once asked him, because he was there in the general staff as a sergeant. He didn't want to be promoted higher because he would have to give orders. So the Lord arranged that he was there in that particular office, in the commanding office of the what we would call here a three-star general, once asked my father a very crucial question. He said, "I want to know from you what you think about the conclusion of the war. Who's going to win?" Now, you don't just speak to a German general who is in charge of the direct command with Berlin what you really think. And my father immediately said, "Sir, is this a private question or is this an official question?" Because there was a rule in the German army. If somebody asked you a private question, you could never be persecuted. It was a gentleman's rule. You could really then speak your mind. If it was an official question, then anything official could happen to you. And the general immediately said, "This is a private question." My father took his little Bible out of the pocket that he has. I have the Bible at home, incidentally. I treasure that Bible. I think it was with me to heaven. I have that Bible there. And he took it out and gave him a Bible study on Daniel 2, showing him that there will be no more world rule on the part of either communism or Nazism or anybody else. He was very impressed. And when he was finished, he says, "Now tomorrow afternoon I call two officers in here and you will give the same information." And my father said, "Sir, this was private." He says, "It will be private tomorrow too." On the following day, he called two officers in, both of whom were history professors at the universities in Germany. And all the dates he gave, 605, Nebuchadnezzar, you know, and the dates and all of that, whenever my father had to give the same Bible study and he told to these officers, "This is a private conversation, that when it's finished, it never took place." Do you understand? "Yes, sir." You know, they understood this. "Yes, sir. This was private." So my father gave the same study, but whenever my father gave a date or a historical circumstance, he said, "Now, how does that fit in history? Because this particular general had a scientific training and not a humanities training." And they said, "Oh, this is right. There was Nebuchadnezzar and there was this world empire and this, everything is fine." When it was all said and done, that officer, that general, started to save gasoline from those meager rations. Enough gasoline in 6 months that unit could escape from Russia and drive back to Germany. And they did. They did. All because of a Bible study. So you never know how the Lord places you in situations that the future you cannot predict, to be a blessing even to those who don't believe. You never know. But while he was out there, my father experienced something that he'd never experienced before. He became actually discouraged. He said, "We are out there. And will you, Lord, allow me ever to see my family again? I mean, we have losses. Every new shipment of soldiers that we get, 200 within 2 weeks, they're gone. They're inexperienced. Another 200, they're gone. Will we ever make it? Will we make it back? It is impossible, humanly speaking." And he prayed to the Lord one night. He says, "Lord, this time I pray for a sign. Give me a sign, Lord, that I may know. If you will, please give me a sign." He got it. The next morning, at 4 o'clock, 200 Russian tanks were approaching toward that little town that they had been located in with just a few soldiers and a few German tanks left. 200. He heard them first. He got out of the schoolroom, ran across up the lookout tower that the Russians had built for themselves and the Germans were using. He looked in the direction from the hillside where these T-34 tanks came down, the battle tanks, the best the Russians had. And he said there was no way that anybody could survive or escape unless we escape with the bare skin of our bodies. My father said, "I don't know how fast I came down that lookout tower and ran across the street and shouted, 'The Russians are here, we have to leave!' And they all rushed up." Now, my dad at that time was in charge of the secret codes to receive the orders and other secret papers. And he knew if he would leave those papers behind, he would be put against the wall for handing over to the enemy documents that would really be valuable to them. He knew if he would wrap them up and take them along, there wasn't time. So he wasn't a dilemma. All of a sudden,
An idea came to his mind as if the Lord had spoken. Push them in the side door. There was the teacher's side room. And close the door. There was a key in the lock. Lock the door. And he took a piece of chalk and wrote down in German, "Don't enter." And he drew a skull and two crossbones. So he ran out. Everybody was gone by that time. He was the last one. Everything was left behind. Everything they owned was left behind. He looked down the road and he saw a German tank pulling away, because he himself had been left behind. The rush was too fast. And he knew he had to run for that tank, to reach that tank. But he didn't quite reach it, except he jumped on the connecting link between the tank and the cannon, the piece of artillery the tank was pulling. He sat down exhausted, and at that moment that tank makes a turn, and he was trying to hold on. He cannot get a grip of anything. He falls down, and his head is in front of the cannon wheel, and he knows that his head will be crushed, and it's the end. And he sees his whole life in a split second, from early till that moment. He says, my whole life was in my mind in a split second. And I quickly prayed, Lord, save me and my family. And somebody grabs him in the back, chucks him away, lifts him through the air about 20 feet, and sets him in the middle of the German tank. And he says, I looked around. I thought, who in the world is there to do this? And he says, I looked and I looked and I looked. And all of a sudden, it dawned upon me, it must have been an angel of the Lord. And he said, then I praised the Lord. He says, I sang hymns on top of the German tank, because I knew I was going to see you kids again, and I would see my wife again. The Lord had shown me. He had shown me. He had shown me. So my father was the first Adventist minister to come back from World War II and began his work again in the summer of 1945, in the city of Frankfurt. He gave Bible studies to Ron Schmidt's mother. Ron Schmidt, you know him? My father gave Bible studies to her mother. She never became an Adventist, but Ron remembers something. Seeds sown, you never know when they sprout. Isn't that fantastic? Our time is up, I notice. I've gone 10 minutes over, and the Lord will forgive me if you forgive me. So, we have to stop because other meetings are beginning. I cannot tell you the last story about Lodi and Lodi, but maybe some other time. Nevertheless, I would like to conclude by saying it pays to be loyal to the Lord. I would like to encourage all of you to renew a decision that you have made in the past. Or if you've never made it, renew it in your own heart. Make it in your own heart and say, Lord, I would like to be loyal to you. I would like to know you the way these three men knew you. And Lord, I need more of you in my life. Come and live out your life within me. If you like to make that renewal or that new decision, I would like to invite you to stand with me, please. And I want to pray to the Lord just a simple prayer now for myself and for all of you. Lord in heaven, we are touched by your faithful servants of the past, your genuine remnant of faith. They were victorious. They were vindicated before the world in their loyalty to you. Lord, I and all of us here would like to manifest that loyalty through your power and strength in our life. Touch us, live in us, stay with us. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.